You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the state's second ever official elk hunt wrapped up this month, and tens of thousands of people tried for a spot. We hear about what went into building back the state's elk population and how concerns about chronic wasting disease factor into its future. First, some dates like September 11th, 2001, or a major election day like November 8th, 2016, go down in history, and many of us know where we were and what we were doing. But what about all of the ordinary days that pass between big newsworthy events? Are they really unremarkable? A couple of journalists decided to test out their hunch that there really is no such thing as an ordinary day. So they had strangers randomly choose a month, a day, and a year in recent history, and then they spent a few years researching that specific date. Gene Weingarten is a Washington Post journalist and a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner for feature writing. His most recent book is One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. Gene, welcome to Central Time.
Very good to be here.
Well, how did you first come up with this idea?
As an editor, I'd always preached the idea that there is a story in absolutely everything. And I decided to check it. You know, I was approaching my mid-60s. I decided that I was too complacent and I needed to try something that would probably fail. So I did this. And astonishingly, it worked out.
And don't keep us in suspense. What date did you end up with?
We wound up with December 28th, 1986, which instantly seemed like a terrible date because it was a Sunday, which is the slowest news day of the week, and it was the slowest week of the year, which is the sleepy week between Christmas and New Year's, and 1986 didn't really ring any big news bells either, so we had what we thought was a lousy day.
Well, interestingly, you did, I have to say, to give you credit, you stuck with that day. You didn't, you know, try to get around your own rules and somehow get a different one, and you ran with it. And interestingly, the first event from December 28, 1986, was something that happened right here in Wisconsin. Tell us about that.
You have to remind me which it was.
It was the death of an author.
It was the death of an author. Yes. Oh, yeah. I had actually forgotten that that happened in Wisconsin. John D. McDonald, who was a prolific and brilliant writer of detective fiction, died on that day. And that was actually the very first thing we found because it was on top of the Google list of what happened that day.
And I did a little poking around in Wisconsin newspapers for other things that happened on that date. One story that caught my attention was in the Kenosha News, so in southeastern Wisconsin. A young mother was rocking her normally very active 20-month-old son to sleep when he started gasping for breath and lost consciousness. The boy's father started giving him mouth-to-mouth, and luckily a county sheriff's deputy was just 1 minute away. He helped with the emergency resuscitation, and they kept the boy alive until the ambulance came. Not only did the toddler survive, he seemed to have no after effects. And in reading that, it reminded me of a lot of the stories that you found, Gene. You know, it's a small local story, but with so much human drama there. Is that the kind of stories that you were hoping to find?
I thought you were going to wind up saying that he wound up being governor or something. But
no, well,
but,
maybe.
But
I don't
yes.
think so.
Who knows? Yes, I found stories that were of enormous importance and drama. Things like there was a heart transplant done by people who had never done a heart transplant before, and it worked out so well that the recipient is still alive and among the longest-lived heart transplant recipients ever, and that happened on that day. There were gigantic stories in the news that I wrote about from small stories spinning out. AIDS was in its full horrible flower then. But there were also these tiny stories that turned out to be phenomenally dramatic once you look at them. There was a couple that met in Long Island that day in a sleazy bar. And the following day, the man took the woman out for a drink, And the following day, they got really drunk at a party and announced that they were engaged. And the following day, he moved into her house, which is the first time he discovered, for example, that she had children. This is like the recipe for a disastrous relationship. And it's still going on. They have been married for 30 years and are incredibly happy. You know, there were little stories like that that also turned out to be phenomenal.
Well, and I was interested in looking, you know, at some of the Wisconsin newspapers. Of course, there wasn't just local news. There was national and international news. And the term Soviets kept popping up. And I thought, wow, that was, you know, that was pre-fall of the Soviet Union.
It was, you know, unfortunately, I'm in my 60s, and Soviets is a very common word for me. I know people in their 30s who barely know what it means. But yes, the Cold War was ending in a particularly grotesque and banal way, and there is a chapter in this book about a single individual, and her experiences pretty much mirror the entire experience of the end of the Cold War.
We're talking right now with Gene Weingarten. He's a Washington Post journalist and a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner for feature writing. We're talking about his most recent book, which is called One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. And Gene, how did you go about digging? You spent several years doing this. How did you go about researching what was happening on that day?
Well, you know, it was supposed to be a pretty easy project. My contract with my publisher said I had to deliver the book 2 years after signing the contract. It's now been 6.5 years and the book finally came out. It proved to be a much more exhausting affair than I expected. The answer to your question is I got information from every possible source. Obviously the internet and Google was extremely helpful in getting initial tips. But mostly this book developed over exhaustive reporting. You know, you find out that something happened, but you don't understand the depth of it or the meaning of it or the drama behind it. And that's what you have to get from talking to hundreds of people. And that's what I did.
So you looked up what happened, what was being reported on that happened on December 28th, 1986. But then you, as you said, you followed the thread. So like, you know, that couple that was making what I think just about everybody would say was likely to be a horrible mistake turned out not to be. Were there other stories that you read, tried to follow up on, and just couldn't find kind of that closure to the story?
Oh, yeah, there were many. There were, you know, I'm primarily a journalist, and there were some stories that just sounded phenomenal, but I couldn't persuade myself that they were true as initially reported and as they were told to me by people who had experienced them. There were remarkable stories that never got into the book because I wasn't sure they were true. Everything in the book is true. And it's remarkably dramatic in its own sense. Essentially, the book is a series of 25 stories, and each one is something I would have been proud to have written as a magazine cover story.
You admit that it was something of a gimmick to do, but there was nothing wrong with that. Gimmicks can lead to an interesting hook. And it really did turn into an interesting snapshot of the country at that moment, didn't it?
It did. And it also, there's something sort of existential in the meaning of a single day. You know, the basic irreducible unit of human experience, midnight to midnight, one day, and it carried that drama with it.
And I have to say, in retrospect, I'm guessing that you might think that seemingly kind of worst possible type of day that you ended up a Sunday in a traditionally slow news time of the year, that actually probably turned into a better book than if you had pulled a date that had something huge that kind of overshadowed everything else.
Absolutely. I wound up being enormously grateful that the challenge started as something that was going to fail, because when it didn't, it kind of proved my thesis, and I was really excited about that. I do think that we would have had an equally good book with absolutely any day chosen, and that was sort of the concept, and it worked out.
And is that kind of your biggest takeaway from the project, that any day is an extraordinary day?
There is no such thing as an ordinary day. That's what I learned.
Well, Gene, thank you so much for joining us today, and it's a really interesting book.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Gene Weingarten is a Washington Post journalist and a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner for feature writing. His most recent book is called One Day, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary 24 Hours in America. He and his partner chose a date at random and researched the news stories of that day. It was December 28, 1986. Coming up, we'll talk about concerns that chronic wasting disease could impact Wisconsin's small wild elk herds. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement is still being negotiated, but a congressional vote on the deal could happen soon. We'll find out where the process stands during our look at the week in Washington. First, Wisconsin's second-ever managed elk hunt wrapped up earlier this month, and it's safe to say it's getting a lot of interest. 23,000 people put their names into a lottery for a license. Ultimately, only 10 lucky hunters were picked to take part. That's in part because the herd's numbers are small, with only about 300 wild elk statewide. But while DNR officials are working to grow the herd and the number of elk hunters in the state, there are questions about the threat posed by chronic wasting disease. Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez spoke to WisContext associate editor Will Cushman, who's been following the issue.
Well, we usually hear about CWD in the context of deer, but you wrote this piece on how it could affect the state's wild elk population. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't really think about CWD and elk, at least in Wisconsin, because we don't have very many elk in Wisconsin. We have like 300 some wild elk and two very small herds. But yeah, it's also a problem in elk herds out west. So we wanted to take a look at what CWD and its spread in Wisconsin could mean for our very small herds.
And to date, there have been no wild elk that have tested positive, right?
That's correct. In Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. And some, though, in elk farms?
Yes, I believe at least one elk in an elk farm. I can't remember whereabouts in the state. I think it was in northwestern Wisconsin. Did test positive for CWD, and a lot of elk out west are CWD positive. They have, I think, a third of the herds in Colorado have elk herds have CWD.
And you talked about the fact that Wisconsin has this very small wild elk population. And part of the reason why this is so important is because there's been this huge effort to rebuild the population. Can you talk about what went into that?
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating. Over the course of decades, really, and it's cost a significant amount of money, both for the state as well as nonprofits and tribes and other individuals. So elk were wiped out in Wisconsin around the same time that they were wiped out throughout most of eastern North America. So that would be in the late 19th century. Not sure exactly when they were totally wiped out from Wisconsin. It was sometime between like the 1860s and 1880s. And then in the early 20th century, there were efforts kind of across the country to reintroduce elk in the eastern states. Most of those elk came from Yellowstone National Park. And so they were reintroduced to a bunch of places, including Wisconsin. But then that was like right before the Great Depression hit, and there weren't really a whole lot of resources, and there wasn't a whole lot of science that would support these reintroduction efforts. So basically the elk were dropped off in Wisconsin and people were like, good luck, let's see how it goes. And they were never heard from again. So no one knows what happened to those elk. But then later in the 20th century, so in the 80s, there was kind of like a grassroots effort. People started to wonder again, why can't we have elk in Wisconsin? We have the habitat for it. So in 1989, the legislature directed the DNR are to conduct a feasibility study to look into how feasible it would be to reintroduce elk, moose, and caribou to the state. And they decided ultimately that none of those species were the state wasn't ready to reintroduce any of those. There wasn't really public support at that time or enough, they thought. But then that really started getting the conversation going. And then in the 90s, some researchers at UW-Stevens Point, in collaboration with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, transported a couple dozen elk from Michigan to the Clam Lake area. That's kind of like southwestern Ashland County near Bayfield County. And they wanted to study how elk could do in the habitat. The herd grew pretty slowly, and after a few years, the DNR took over management. And then in the 2000s, the DNR really ramped up their efforts to reintroduce elk, started working with the state of Kentucky, and again with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And in that effort, they have brought up over 100 elk from the state of Kentucky. That's now over, but there are now 250-some elk near the Clam Lake herd in northern Wisconsin and about 75 elk in Jackson County in the Black River State Forest.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisConText, and we're talking to him about his latest reporting on chronic wasting disease and the risk it poses to the state's small wild elk population. Will, what do we know about how CWD affects elk?
So it affects elk in a similar way that it affects deer and all cervids. Cervids are hoofed mammals, a group of hoofed mammals that includes deer, moose, elk, reindeer, caribou. And what it does, so CWD is caused by what they're called prions. They're basically abnormal proteins that a deer or an elk will pick up in the environment. And once they're infected with it, those prions start replicating in their brains and replacing healthy brain proteins. And eventually that leads to muscle weakness and eventual death, hence why it's called chronic wasting disease. But elk are affected in a pretty similar way to deer, in the way that basically they have about 2 years or so after they're infected before they ultimately die.
And you spoke to the DNR for this piece. Mm-hmm. How worried are they about CWD and the elk population?
You know, it was interesting talking to them. So I spoke with Kevin Wallenfang. He's a deer and elk ecologist for the DNR, and he's kind of in charge of elk management in the state. And he said that they're not super worried about CWD in the herds because the prevalence rates, so the number of elk in a herd who test positive for CWD in the herds where it's present, like out west, tend to be lower than the number of deer in infected herds that become infected. So he said that, and research supports this, like up to 50% of deer in a herd that's been infected with CWD will test positive for it, whereas it kind of tops out around 1 in 10 elk in an infected herd. So it doesn't seem to affect elk quite as much as deer in terms of like a population standpoint. That said, researchers aren't really sure why that is, if it has something to do with elk biology or if it has something to do with the habits of elk. They have different social habits, grazing habits. So they're not necessarily super worried about CWD in Wisconsin's elk, but they're definitely going to pretty, I wouldn't call them extreme, but great lengths to protect the herds. So there have been bull elk in particular kind of range out past like where the typical herd range is. And there have been a couple bull elk, Kevin said, that have strayed from their herds in Wisconsin into areas where CWD is known to be present. I should say that CWD hasn't been found in the home ranges of either herd. But these elk, these bull elk that have strayed into CWD areas or potentially areas with CWD, the DNR is able to track them with radio collars, and they have made the decision to euthanize them immediately before returning them, before they could return to the herds, out of just like a lot of a lot of caution.
Yeah, and you talked to a couple other experts on this, and it sounds like they very much supported that practice.
Yep. I talked to a staff biologist at the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and he agreed with that, as did a researcher at the University of Illinois who helps head up Illinois' efforts to control CWD and its whitetail herd.
And when it comes to demand for elk hunting, we just wrapped up our second official elk hunt in the state. It sounds like there's a lot of interest in doing this.
There's so much demand. Yeah. And like way more demand than there are elk.
Right.
Yeah. I think 2018 was the first sanctioned elk hunt in the state. The DNR gave out 10 tags, 5 to tribal members and 5 to other residents in Wisconsin. And they had like over 38,000 applicants for
wow.
those tags. And then in 2019, it was a similar number. It was a little bit lower, but it was still like tens of thousands of people were applying for just a few elk tags.
And so big picture, as we wrap up, are the people managing Wisconsin's wild elk population, are they optimistic about the chances of the population surviving CWD or dealing with it?
They are pretty optimistic about it, especially now that they are really feeling confident about where the herds are now in terms of population growth. The herd up in Clam Lake has been growing like really pretty slowly over the last couple of decades. I mean, it's still only a couple hundred elk. But I guess now they have, as of this year or this coming spring, they'll have over 100 cows that will be probably giving birth. So they're expecting like quite a population boom up near Clam Lake. And the Jackson County herd is also, it's been dealing with some issues related to vehicle accidents, killing a number of elk. But I guess all of the calves that have been born in Jackson County over the last 2 years have survived so far. So that is also pointing toward kind of some optimism for both herds.
Thanks so much, Will.
Thank you.
That was Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez speaking with WisContext associate editor Will Cushman. If you want to find out more about the risks from chronic wasting disease and Wisconsin's wild elk herds, you can find Will's story at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Congress and the White House are within range of an agreement on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. We'll find out where things stand during our look at the week in Washington. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Evers vetoed a bill last week that would have lowered the amount of training required for certified nursing assistants. We hear from a lawmaker who supported the legislation. First, we're taking a look at the week in Washington. The House Judiciary Committee is getting ready to launch its portion of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The Democratic presidential field has 2 new candidates, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says an agreement on the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal is close, but President Trump says he wants a vote on the deal immediately. And we want to hear from you. You can share your thoughts on the USMCA at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what's being negotiated and where the process stands? Do you want to see it get a vote from Congress sooner rather than later? Do you think uncertainty over a North American trade deal has affected your business or line of work? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. He's with us from the nation's capital. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
Well, let's start with the latest on the impeachment inquiry. The last 2 weeks were filled with public hearings. Now it's moving into a new phase. What's next?
So basically what's happened is the impeachment probe is now kind of being taken over by the Judiciary Committee. Initially, it was with the Intelligence Committee. And so two next steps in the process. First is that the Intelligence Committee is going to write a report on all the evidence they gathered, both in private depositions and in public hearings over the last couple of weeks. And they'll basically present that to the Judiciary Committee. But it'll basically summarize all the evidence that they've got and sort of make the Democrats' case for impeaching the president, or for potentially impeaching the president. The second thing that's going to happen is this next week, the Judiciary Committee is going to hold its own public hearing to kind of look at the legal framework around impeachment and try to, sort of decide whether the things that have been the president's acts that have been uncovered by the Intelligence Committee, whether, those rise to the level of being impeachable offenses. And what they've essentially said is they're going to bring in, lawyers and other experts to kind of, discuss the kind of constitutional parameters around impeachment. And they've invited the White House to take part, invited the president to send a lawyer to take part. At this point, it doesn't look like the White House is going to do that, but they essentially do have an opportunity to put up their own lawyer to basically make the case that that the conduct that has been, has been revealed in the last number of weeks is not impeachable. So those are really the two next steps that are going to happen. And then after that, it'll be up to the Judiciary Committee to decide, whether or not they want to draft articles of impeachment and submit those to the House for a vote. At this point, it looks likely that they will do that. It's just a question of exactly how they frame the articles of impeachment and what the exact wording is.
Do we have any sense how long this Judiciary Committee phase of the process might take?
The Democrats have generally lean towards having everything wrapped up by the end of the year. So most likely it would probably only be, 2 to 3 weeks that the Judiciary Committee, if they do stick to that timeline, only 2 or 3 weeks that the Judiciary Committee would be doing this work and then drafting the articles of impeachment and then presumably voting on them and sending them to the full House. So, most likely it'll be a relatively swift process. But at this point, the Democrats have not really laid out a hard and fast timeline for how quickly they're going to move. There just is this kind of notion, I guess, that they'd like to have this all wrapped up by the end of the year, at least have a vote on the articles by the full House by the end of the year.
The public hearing portion of the inquiry has been the big story for weeks now. Do we have any sense, Adrian, whether it has shifted the conversation that lawmakers are having in any way?
It certainly hasn't moved public opinion, in terms of, how many people are convinced of the president's, guilt or innocence. And it definitely hasn't. And I think because of that, it hasn't really shifted where the respective congressional caucuses are at. I mean, it's still very much a partisan divide at this point where, the Democrats seem, the Democrats, I suppose, do seem, more convinced than ever that that going ahead and impeaching the president is the thing to do, is the way to go. But it certainly hasn't. The impeachment hearing certainly didn't shift any of the political calculus for the Republican Party. They're still very much, loyal to the president. And so, it looks very likely at this point that what will probably happen is that the Democratic majority in the House, will approve articles of impeachment against the president and basically set up a trial in the Senate. But it seems very, very unlikely that the Senate, where the Republicans have a majority, would convict Trump and remove him from office. So it's likely that Trump will be impeached by the House, but it's likely that he will be saved by the Senate and ultimately will stay in office.
And new reporting today says that President Trump knew of the whistleblower complaint before he released military aid to Ukraine in September. Why is that piece of news significant?
It basically suggests that Trump was going for a quid pro quo on the military aid, because one of the arguments that Republicans have tried to use during the hearings in the last couple of weeks was that, yes, there was this military aid that was withheld from Ukraine. Yes, President Trump wanted an investigation, Ukraine to do these investigations into his political opponents. But, at the end of the day, Ukraine didn't announce, any such investigations, and they still got their military aid anyway. It was unfrozen in September. So the fact that if Trump really did know, before he released the military aid, that this whistleblower complaint had come forward, it suggests that he didn't release the aid because he wanted to, give the aid to Ukraine. It suggests that he only released the aid because he knew that that it could, very soon Congress might be on to him, the public might be on to him, and might find out what he was trying to do. So it basically is just one more sort of piece of evidence that weighs the ways in favor of the case that the president was trying to set up some sort of quid pro quo here by essentially ransoming military aid to Ukraine to get Ukraine to launch these investigations into Biden and the Democrats.
We're talking with Adrian Morrow right now. He's the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. And we're looking at some of the biggest political news out of Washington this week. And Adrian, this week, a federal judge ordered that former White House lawyer Don McGahn must obey a subpoena to testify in the impeachment inquiry. That ruling has now been stayed after the Justice Department appealed it. Can you talk about what's at stake in this particular case?
You know, Don McGahn was one of the key sources for the information in the Mueller report earlier this year, where he basically told Mueller, in detail about times that Trump had tried to have McGahn or wanted McGahn to fire Robert Mueller so that Mueller would basically stop investigating, potential Russian collusion by Trump's, campaign and collusion between Trump's campaign and the Russians. And so, McGahn basically provides perhaps the strongest evidence that the Democrats can find that Trump may have attempted to obstruct justice by having Mueller fired. And so having McGahn testify before the impeachment inquiry would be very strong evidence, for the Democrats. At least on the obstruction of justice side. So basically, the White House has tried to stop anybody, who worked for the administration, former like McGahn or current people, from testifying to Congress. And so basically, this legal fight is between, the Democrats at Congress who want McGahn and other White House officials to testify, and the Trump administration that wants to stop any of those people from going in front of Congress. And so essentially not only would McGahn's testimony in itself be valuable to the Democrats in Congress, but if this judge's ruling is held up as a precedent, then it could make it easier for Congress to subpoena, to basically force all these other officials in the White House to come testify before Congress. However, basically what I think the Trump administration is calculating is that, they know that the Democrats want the impeachment inquiry to wrap up relatively quickly, that they don't want this to go on beyond the end of the year. And so I think what they, the reasoning here is that if they can file as many appeals as possible, kind of use every legal, tool in the tool belt to keep this in the court system, they can basically wait the Democrats out, that they can essentially ensure that, a final ruling, from the Supreme Court or from any other court on whether or not McGahn and other officials have to testify, they can make sure that ruling happens, months and months down the line, at such a point that it's sort of, long after the Democrats want to have the inquiry wrapped up. So that's sort of where things are at, where the Republicans are, the White House rather is trying to ensure that this court process drags out so long that neither McGahn nor anybody else within the White House who's been subpoenaed by Congress will ever actually have to testify.
And before we leave the impeachment topic, President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, has been a key figure in the inquiry and in the news a lot this past week. Right now, federal investigators are looking into the actions of two of his associates who have recently been charged with campaign finance violations. What's going on in this aspect of the issue?
Yeah, basically, Giuliani worked with these two associates in Ukraine on a number of things, including attempting to find dirt on Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son. But what's happening now is that both of these guys are charged with allegedly illegally funneling foreign campaign contributions to a pro-Trump political action committee in the U.S. And then on top of that, investigators are looking into, whether Giuliani, is engaged in either the conduct that his two associates were involved in, or in other business dealings with Ukraine that weren't entirely above board, including being an agent for a foreign government, not registering as an agent and that sort of thing. What could potentially happen here is that, and it's already started to happen, where the lawyer for one of the guys that Giuliani was working with has talked about how his client is potentially willing to give evidence to the impeachment inquiry, and so it's possible that because of these charges, these associates of Giuliani's, might sort of turn on him and be willing to give evidence to Congress that's incriminating either for Giuliani, on a personal level and his sort of legal situation, or that that adds more information to the case against the president. So that's sort of how this could ultimately, you know, affect the impeachment inquiry, beyond being obviously, you know, potentially legal hot water for Giuliani himself.
We're talking right now with Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for The Globe and Mail, and we're looking at the week's top political news, including the latest on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. We will be going to that after just a short break, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what's still being hammered out about this deal? Is it important to you that it gets passed soon? Are there certain parts of a new North American trade deal that would be important for your line of work? And do you think uncertainty over this trade deal has impacted your livelihood? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our talk now with Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for The Globe and Mail, looking at the week's top political news. And Adrian, let's move on from impeachment and talk about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the trade deal that could replace NAFTA. It's been approved by both Canada and Mexico, but the U.S. Congress has yet to vote on it. Where does it stand?
So right now there's basically a negotiation going on between Democrats in Congress and the Trump administration, where the Democrats basically are saying, you know, we'll only approve your deal and pass it through the House of Representatives if you make certain changes, particularly on labor, the environment, pharmaceuticals, and the enforceability of the deal, only if you make those changes that we want to see. The issue is that a lot of the changes that the Democrats want can only be made if Canada and Mexico agree to them, and Mexico has already ratified the new USMCA. So basically, what the Trump administration is trying to do is that they basically want Canada and Mexico to agree to a side letter, which would essentially be an addition to the deal that would add some things or change some things to please congressional Democrats. So there's been some back and forth between the Trump administration and the Mexicans over the last few weeks about this. And today what's happening in a short while here in Washington is that Chrystia Freeland, the Canadian Deputy Prime Minister, is going to meet with Robert Lighthizer, who's Trump's trade chief, and with Jesus Seade, who's kind of the main Mexican negotiator on the USMCA. And basically, they're going to try to come to some sort of agreement that will basically add, be a side letter that will essentially add some things to the USMCA to please congressional Democrats. So it's essentially going to be a negotiation between the three sides to see what Canada and Mexico are willing to agree to that the Democrats want, that Lighthizer and the Trump administration can take back to Congress and say, okay, is this enough if we give you this for you to pass the deal?
And here's President Trump speaking over the weekend, urging Speaker Pelosi to bring the deal up for a vote.
All she has to do is say, we're putting it up for a vote, like immediately. And a lot of time is being wasted, but you're going to have Mexico and Canada pull it pretty soon. And if they do, it's her fault, not mine. We gave you a great deal. It's her fault.
Adrian, is there talk of Mexico or Canada pulling out of the deal?
No, not at all. Trump's just making that up. Mexico has already ratified the deal. Canada has committed to ratifying it as soon as the U.S. moves forward on it. So at this point, it really is just a question of, will Canada and Mexico agree to enough of the things that the Democrats want, that's going to be, going to be something that the Democrats will be able to say, okay, that's enough. We sort of got our victory on a couple of points. And so we're willing to do the ratification. At this point, basically what Trump is basically just trying to do is put pressure on the Democrats by sort of creating this idea that somehow if this deal doesn't get passed, Canada and Mexico are going to walk away from it. But that's not the case at all. I mean, at this point, I think Canada and Mexico are sort of happy to negotiate, and to sort of see what, see where they're able to get.
And you are from Canada. You represent a Canadian newspaper. Is there anything in particular about the discussion in Canada that would be good for us to know?
Well, one of there are really two sort of major things at this point that seem to be on the table in the deal. And ironically, one of the things that that the Democrats want Canada and Mexico to agree to is actually something that Canada and Mexico wanted in the original USMCA negotiations last year, but that the Trump administration refused to give them, which is basically an improvement to the one of the dispute resolution mechanisms, where essentially, there's a process where, you know, when you have a dispute between two of the different countries in the NAFTA deal, under NAFTA, there's a trade tribunal that has to be constituted with members from each country to adjudicate the dispute. And the U.S. Has often used this, has been able to obstruct some of these tribunals from doing their work by just refusing to appoint members to them. And so one of the things that Canada demanded, and I believe Mexico was on board with this too, demanded during the USMCA negotiations, was that they sort of fix this problem and basically, force all three countries to always, appoint members to these tribunals to make sure that these trade disputes could be adjudicated. Lighthizer does not like trade panels. He doesn't, he thinks that they're an impingement on sovereignty. And he thinks that it would be, he basically wanted almost all these trade tribunals to be gutted or abolished entirely in the deal. And so the compromise that they essentially reached on that particular type of dispute resolution was that the status quo would just remain unchanged in the deal. And so ironically now, what the Democrats are demanding is basically that Lighthizer give Canada and Mexico a little bit of what they wanted initially during the negotiations. So I think from Canada's perspective, there could actually be an additional NAFTA victory or USMCA victory if they really do end up incorporating some of this language into the side letter. So that's really maybe the biggest upshot for Canada is the fact that there could be a kind of an additional victory there. The second issue, which I think is going to be much harder, and it's kind of the main issue between the U.S. and Mexico, is that congressional Democrats want provisions in USMCA that would allow American inspectors to go into Mexican factories and ensure that the factories are following some of the tougher labor laws labor language that Mexico agreed to under USMCA. Mexico doesn't like that idea because they think it's an infringement on their sovereignty to have American inspectors, come onto their turf essentially and inspect their factories. So that one I think will be a harder that might be the Gordian knot that they have to untangle at the negotiating table. But really, those sort of to me anyway kind of seem like the two major issues at this point. One of which could be a victory for Canada. If it really does, get into the deal. And you could see a funny alignment between Canada, Mexico, and congressional Democrats against the Trump administration. And then the second one, which could be a much harder negotiation between the U.S. and Mexico.
You mentioned the negotiating table. And of course, we hear a lot from Presidents Trump and Lopez Obrador and also Prime Minister Trudeau, people like Nancy Pelosi, a Speaker of the House. But who is actually at that table, hammering out these details?
So the three main people are it's Chrystia Freeland, who is the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. So she was the foreign minister and basically handled the original USMCA negotiations in a cabinet shuffle last week after Trudeau's as Trudeau begins his second mandate as prime minister. She was shuffled from the foreign ministry to be Deputy Prime Minister. So essentially Trudeau's second in command. But she's kept the Canada-U.S. relations portfolio as part of her mandate. So she's the main person for Canada. On the U.S. side, it's Bob Lighthizer, who is the U.S. trade representative. So he's sort of almost the equivalent to a trade minister, that sort of thing in other governments. And his job is basically to handle U.S. trade policy and U.S. trade negotiations. And he's much like Trump. He's pretty much a protectionist, sort of a true believer, economic nationalist type. And so he's very much aligned with Trump kind of ideologically. And then on the Mexican side, it's a guy named Jesus Seade. And he's basically has sort of North American trade as his portfolio. And he wasn't he was sort of involved a little bit at the very end of the original USMCA negotiations. But those negotiations were mostly handled by the previous Mexican government under Enrique Peña Nieto. And then he kind of came in at the end as a representative of López Obrador, who had won the election but had not yet taken over as president at the time that the original negotiations were done. But he's now sort of he's López Obrador's guy, basically. And so he's the main person for Mexico kind of handling the talks. So it's really those three basically are the three kind of principals, I guess, at the table who have to hammer this out.
And very briefly, Adrian, in our last half minute or so, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick and former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg have joined the Democratic primary slate. Is that going to change much?
That's a good question. You know, I think both of them getting into the race is really a reflection of the fact that that some Democrats, at least in the center, you know, feel a little bit uninspired by Joe Biden and, you know, aren't really sure that there's a strong sort of moderate centrist type candidate who's able to hold back Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, who have, you know, basically tended to run probably the strongest campaigns or have had sort of the strongest campaign so far on the left of the party. But that said, I mean, there are already so many candidates and so many moderate candidates in the race already. It's really not clear that that Bloomberg or Patrick are going to be able to pull away enough supporters from either Joe Biden or Pete Buttigieg or Kamala Harris.
And we'll leave it there. Adrian, thanks for joining us. Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. He was with us for our weekly roundup of the top news coming out of Washington, D.C. If you were watching TV on October 30th, 1978, you may have heard these immortal words.
As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
That was from the Thanksgiving show on the sitcom WKRP in Cincinnati. Reporter Les Nessman was reporting from a shopping mall where a holiday turkey giveaway went horribly wrong.
Oh, my God, they're turkeys!
Pushing each other? Oh, my goodness. Oh, the humanity. People are running about. The turkeys are hitting the ground like sacks of wet cement.
It turns out that the episode was inspired by real, although slightly less dramatic, events. A friend of one of the writers was working at a radio station in Texas in the 1960s, and that man's son says there was a live turkey promotion, but instead of being thrown from a helicopter, they were pushed off the back of a moving pickup truck. Even at a much lower altitude, it didn't end well for the turkeys. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. From all of us on Central Time, we hope you have a fun and safe Thanksgiving.